Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We have Jonathan Mills here, and fortunately we were able to pick him up. He's on the way down to Canberra tomorrow for an investiture, since he was awarded an AO in the recent honours list. So congratulations, Jonathan. And tonight he's going to speak for us on the topic, the ABC and the arts, a consequent relationship.
A relationship of consequence.
Oh, sorry, I can't read the writing. A relationship of consequence. I'll introduce Jonathan very briefly. He qualified in music at Sydney University, did his Master of Architecture at RMIT in Melbourne. He's worked in music and in universities as a festival director. He's worked as a curator and a composer. But, of course, he's currently director of the Edinburgh Festival since 2007. And so tonight Jonathan's going to speak for us on the ABC and the arts, a relationship of consequence. Many thanks.
Thank you, Gerard. The catalyst for this speech is a series of recent decisions taken by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which seem to demonstrate a style and emphasis of its management in relationship to the arts, which deserves to be examined in the context of the history and origins of the ABC itself, and more specifically in terms of the charters which in 1932 and in 1983 established it. I'd like to use this speech to test the contours of an argument which is rather fragmentary, an amalgam of anecdote, impression, analysis, experience and intuition. Approaching any discussion about the ABC and its relationship to the arts will always be complex, even picaresque. I would like to identify some linkages between a series of phenomena, between the threads of action and influence through which individual artists from time to time and from generation to generation have tentatively explored ways of connecting to what might vaguely resemble, in Australia and in other places such as Europe or India, be loosely called a cultural continuum, something approaching a pattern of influence which, while not exactly forging anything as coherent or consistent as a tradition, at least points to attitudes which accumulate some recognisable patterns or sequences. Running in parallel, if not concurrent, with such tentative quasi-historical impressions is a recent conundrum of rather seismic proportions. A shift, as a result of the advent of digital technologies and the internet, in the ways in which our memory functions. Literally, the ways we choose or are encouraged to remember things, to collect and preserve our stories, allegories, myths, personal and communal histories. And furthermore, the capacity and disposition of individuals and societies to connect with anything resembling a cultural memory. In her seminal book, The Art of Memory, the historian Frances Yates describes with power and elegance aspects of the great classical mnemonic traditions whereby memory and knowledge were embodied and considered an intrinsic, inextricable part of a human being. Were Dame Frances alive today, she would have a field day comparing her art of memory between those moments when in 1450 Johannes Gutenberg's printing press started in Mainz and when sometime in 1989 or 1990 Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Kao used hypertext procedures to create the World Wide Web. Following Professor Yates' thesis, the shift from extemporised oration to printed page and further onto computer screen can be understood as a relentless process, from an intimate embodiment of knowledge through memory to a disconnection and separation of facts and fictions on printed pages of prescribed standardised proportions, bound within manuscripts and both hard and soft-covered books, deposited in libraries or archives, literally the physical architecture of the labyrinths of our minds and their memories, through to the total disembodied, unpaginated, virtual, borderless infinity of the internet. A world in which the mnemonic feats of oratory of Plato or Cicero, delivering lengthy speeches that were staggering in their logical subtlety and virtuosic in their palindromic reversibility, these have ceded to what one digital age commentator has described as an era of partial, continuous attention. The specific implications of the internet, and more broadly of an era of digital technology, are profound, never more so than for an institution such as the ABC. The role of the arts in contemporary society has similarly undergone a radical transformation. The last decade, let alone half century, has seen a total technological renovation of the collection and dissemination of all manner of information, of data of any kind, sound, text, and image. The memory capacity of a personal computer or mobile phone today exceeds that of a supercomputer of the 1950s. It is entirely possible to retain or capture on a small shiny disk the contents of vast libraries, galleries, and museums, or the repertoires of opera houses and concert halls. There have been enormous changes in my own field of composition, the way in which music is recorded and distributed, even downloaded, the manner in which scores are produced and published, an almost revolutionary elaboration of the use and function of musical instruments, and most especially the analogue and digital sonic treatments that are now available to the point of domestic ubiquity. Nor is it the technological context of composition or the arts alone that has changed. The social circumstances for contemporary artists are radically altered too. An example of what I mean. The music of composers such as Monteverdi, Mozart or Mahler, to take three very different examples, could not be amplified and was entirely acoustic. Even the raucous chaos of the sound of the marketplace was straightforward by comparison to the possibility of displaced schizophrenia offered by electronic technology. It was not possible to simulate being anywhere else. Radio had not been invented, and sampling, that now rather mainstream process to be found in almost every disco DJ's bag of tricks, whereby short musical samples of any kind of music or recorded sound can be removed and reconfigured elsewhere, well, such concepts were just too bizarre. The ABC was created in part to take advantage of some of these conceptual and technological shifts and opportunities. From the 1930s, at the beginning of the advent of radio, the Australian government decided that the whole country should share an exciting new technological innovation. And voila, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, complete with brand new studios and premises in each state capital, was born. Its activities supported by no less than six professional orchestras, as well as the quaintly named wireless choruses, several dance bands, and even, until 1951, a military band. A brave new world of technology aligned with the best of our European heritage in a newly formed nation finding its way in the world. When the Australian Broadcasting Commission was established on the 1st of July 1932, Australia, like the rest of the world, was in the midst of a Great Depression. Unemployment was in the region of 23% of the then mostly male workforce. GDP was the equivalent of about $6 billion, and the population was approximately 6.7 million people. Joseph Lyons replaced James Scullin as Prime Minister. It was the year in which the Sydney Harbour Bridge opened, the dog on the Tuckerbox statue in Gundagai was unveiled, and Farlap died. When in 1983 the Commission became the Corporation, Australia was again suffering from an economic downturn, though nothing like the dimensions of the Great Depression. Bob Hawke replaced Malcolm Fraser as Prime Minister. The High Court blocked the construction of the Franklin Dam. Alan Bond and his consortium won the America's Cup. Treasurer Keating floated the Australian dollar. And our population had reached 15.5 million people. Today, as a result of several decades of social and economic reforms, and notwithstanding the political complexities and policy challenges facing our current generation of elected representatives, Australia is, at least in terms of its financial prospects, the envy of the world. There probably always will be serious issues surrounding the funding of any public institution of the size and ambition of the ABC. However, we need to remind ourselves that any such thoughts, at the moment at least, are conducted in an environment of unprecedented prosperity. Australia is rich and free, a country with a nominal GDP of $1.25 trillion, the 13th largest in the world, and a per capita GDP of $55,000, ranking it as number six, a country that also ranks as second in the United Nations Human Development Index. Surely such a country can afford a debate about the relationship between public broadcasting and culture. The original impetus to establish the ABC was consistent with a pattern of nation building, and in the case of Australia was undertaken in part due to the recognition of the particular challenges of distance and isolation in various communities throughout this vast continent. Indeed, the geographic and demographic dimensions of Australia exerted a significant influence on the ways in which these debates and decisions were originally framed. One of Australia's greatest challenges concerns critical mass. There are so few of us. Therefore, everything we do assumes an importance that, in comparisons to places like Europe, the US, China, or India, cannot be taken for granted. The context in which our artists operate is altogether more fragile and exposed. Beyond the democratizing instincts of inclusion and access, I would like to think there was another equally powerful motivation behind the establishment of the ABC. I would like to believe that the process of nation building to which I have referred a moment ago was accompanied by an impulse towards the need not only to build things, roads, houses, ports, railways, hospitals or airports, but to create institutions, universities, libraries, galleries, parliaments, courts, research laboratories like the CSIRO, as well as public broadcasters. And that such actions were part of a deliberate, systematic acknowledgement that any nation needs both physical and creative capacity. Creativity is elusive. It is messy, certainly not illusory. Relationships with creative individuals are never straightforward. Unhelpfully, there are no strategies or policies that will guarantee the emergence, existence, or even effectiveness of a creative impulse. Nurturing creativity requires enormous patience. Rarely does anything worthwhile emanate quickly or in some kind of conveniently prepackaged format. Some scientific advances, for example, take years to unravel and comprehend. Some works of art are so confronting, even revolutionary, that several generations after they are first experienced and they continue to baffle audiences. Creativity can also be wasteful. It takes scores of conductors, instrumentalists, composers, a multitude of actors, writers, designers, a vast network of computer and techno nerds, reels of film directors and producers to establish an environment which is conducive to significant scientific, artistic and technological advancement. To be truly effective, a culture of ideas, surely the sort of entity to which the ABC aspires, must be led by people who think within a medium, who somehow penetrate the nucleus of a thought, rather than being situated as observers on the sidelines. These are people who design, draw, sculpt, paint or photograph, who compose, write, perform or dance, who calculate, measure, experiment, explore and observe. The list is not exhaustive. They are not usually people who manage or promote. Furthermore, these creative individuals cannot survive in isolation. They are too important to exist on the fringes of society. Their ideas must be valued and placed at the centre of our public life. To be truly effective, a culture of ideas has rarely been led by people whose careers have never required them to venture into the often confronting uncertainty and instability of a creative realm. Unfortunately, in Australia at the moment, the people in charge of many of the public institutions responsible for supporting creativity are disconnected from these vital processes and stimuli. When I first graduated in composition from Sydney University, the most important professional opportunities offered to me came from ABC Radio. I would like to acknowledge the role of the ABC has played in my own development as a composer and artistic director over many years. Programs like Surface Tension and The Listening Room offered me, and many others, opportunities to explore our creative boundaries in ways which have not existed for many years. I would like to think that on occasions I have returned the compliment. A radio feature produced by Jane Ullman, based on my composition Sandokan Threnody, which was a very personal homage to Australian prisoners of war incarcerated in North Borneo in 1942, won the Prix Italia in 2004. and in 2008, Channel 4, in conjunction with ABC Television, offered librettist Dorothy Porter and me the chance to have one of our operas, The Eternity Man, made for television by the British filmmaker Julian Temple. Few of these programmes or resources exist today. Despite reassurances from ABC management that any number of changes over decades to programmes, schedules and producers would not diminish the organisation's commitment to commissioning original material, my own experience has been contrary to that claim. Programmes like those I've just mentioned were not invented to chase ratings. They were designed to build opportunities for artists, talented and dedicated individuals in whom Australia's education systems have made significant investments. It is precisely because I owe such a debt of gratitude to the ABC that I am so concerned to think that the opportunities once available to me are being considerably diminished for the future. The ideas and impulses upon which the ABC was founded were subtle, nuanced and complex, and they are, I believe, expressed very clearly in the corporation's own charter. The ABC's charter is a remarkable document. It is unpretentious and concise. Some commentators have criticised it for being too vague. I disagree. I think it would be most unfortunate were the ABC's charter to be too prescriptive. As Clause 4 makes clear, one would not want to impose expensive and protracted litigation as a fundamental condition on how the ABC could or should arrange its affairs. Such impositions would be impractical and a serious potential threat to the independence of the organisation. The charter is interesting both for its inclusions and its omissions. I'm impressed by its sense of balance, expressed through clauses such as 1A1, encouraging programmes that contribute to a sense of national identity, 1B1, which is to encourage awareness of Australia and an international understanding of Australian attitudes on world affairs, or clause 2A3, to provide a balance between broadcasting programmes of wide appeal and specialised broadcasting programmes. The most powerful impression that I take from reading the Charter is an entreaty to consider the often reciprocal relationships with the arts, which the arts so eloquently, perhaps uniquely, offer in terms of creative ambition and an awareness of one's place in the world. It is, I would suggest, no accident that the Charter contains a simultaneous appeal to Australia's view of itself and the impressions which the ABC is urged to create beyond these shores. I would like to think that those who devised the Charter, and most especially Clause 1C, demonstrated remarkable insight and wisdom into the essentially ephemeral nature of performance in the performing arts. Clause 1C states that one of the principal functions of the ABC is to encourage and promote the musical, dramatic and other performing arts in Australia. Perhaps it was apparent to our predecessors that while museums and galleries were appropriate repositories for our visual culture, for painting, sculpture, for the various objects and artefacts of significance to our history as important components in any evolving national or intimate conversation or reflection in which we may wish to participate over successive generations, there is a particular challenge within the performing arts in capturing, at least as a matter of some kind of public record, the performances, the music, the drama, the dance, operas and ballets that constitute other important parts of our heritage. The recent announcement by the ABC that the television programmes Art Nation and The New Inventors would cease production at the end of 2011 is one thing. The accompanying announcement that, in the face of an increasingly competitive broadcasting environment and increasing financial pressures, ABC TV must ensure it uses its government funding as efficiently as possible to deliver maximum value to its audiences and the Australian taxpayer, and as a result, to reduce the levels of staff in New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Western Australia and Northern Territory production pools, resulting in proposed staff redundancies, is a decision which, whilst conforming to a certain logic, would, according to those who are familiar with the management protocols of the ABC, effectively disband the ABC's arts unit, the in-house production resource charged with the key responsibility of coordinating, if not commissioning or curating, an arts policy on behalf of the ABC. Such a situation is entirely more serious and problematic than any announcement concerning the future of a couple of niche programmes. Mark Scott, writing in The Age on the 7th of September, said that the loss of a 30-minute Sunday afternoon arts magazine programme with an audience in significant decline should not be conflated with the end of arts programming. I'm delighted to hear it, and I agree with him. However, the issue is not the loss of a particular programme, rather the connected decision to disband the arts unit at ABC TV. The crux of the matter here must be an assessment of how the arts are best supported, and any such assessment must include a deep understanding of how the arts, and most especially the performing arts, operate. The processes from conception through commissioning to creation, revision, rehearsing to fully staged production and performance is complex. And this must not even begin to deal with adapting live performance to the particular idioms of broadcast. Mr. Scott goes on to say that ABC TV's decision to end the Sunday afternoon slot and shift art stories into prime time should be seen for what it is, a chance for the ABC to connect this content with as wide an audience as possible. Such an initiative is laudable. However, a note of caution. Any decision to change the schedule is likely to be received with a degree of cynicism, especially from the arts community. We've all heard such things before, and the results have often been the reverse of what was claimed. The reference to prime time seems to indicate a mindset which is at odds with a central characteristic of digital technology. The whole point of digital convergence is that it dispenses with linear time or conventional chronologies and makes decreasing sense of the division of media time into prime or even downtime. This could be a moment when the ABC should be commissioning its heart out with great alacrity. When media time zones are collapsing, content, the more distinctive the better, should be considered supreme. The process of commissioning, especially in the arts, is rather intricate. I'm not arguing against a model of public broadcasting which insists on producing everything in-house. There is ample evidence, especially in the development and production of drama, of collaborations between public broadcasters and independent producers working very successfully together. Equally, I do not think it appropriate to the autonomy of a public broadcasting organisation to outsource the majority of its material. And I believe that by evidence, this is a trend that is happening at the ABC at the moment. There is a need for balance. And any desire for equilibrium must be accompanied by an understanding of both the financial sustainability of co-production arrangements in specialist areas such as the arts, science, or natural history, as well as an equally powerful argument for the existence of some form of curatorial continuity, call it a cultural memory, if you like, through which public broadcasters such as the ABC provide the arts with an evolving narrative. The decision to do away with the arts unit on ABC TV has generated a small but rather articulate reaction from the arts community throughout Australia, a flurry of letters containing, as one might expect from those involved, some rather colourful accusations provoking equally indignant responses have been widely circulated in the urban salons of Melbourne and Sydney, especially in recent weeks. In an editorial last week, The Australian observed that the broadcaster's charter requires it to be an entertaining showcase of creative Australian talent and gives it considerable freedom to decide what that means in practice. What it has meant in recent times is a lack of distinction and differentiation from commercial television. Too often, it has confused substance with form and spread itself too thinly as it tries to compete with, rather than complement, private operators. In the same edition of The Australian, an article by the BBC's former Australian correspondent Nick Bryant appeared. He spends much of the article refuting some of the well-worn clichés which have characterised Australia's reputation in the past. He describes Australia as an increasingly consequential country, unrecognisable from the journalistic kingdom of the mind of old, a land good for the occasional and finely animal story, a bizarre outback crime or two, and in the eyes of many foreign news organisations, not a whole lot more. He continues to dispel the cartoon script version of Australia by describing the economic, social and cultural achievements of Australia over the past few years in glowing terms. He even goes so far as to suggest that we are a nation where the tyranny of distance no longer brings with it the felony of neglect. Now that the locus of global economic activity has shifted from the Atlantic to the Pacific, proximity has become more defining than distance. The land down under, a phrase dripping with inconsequentiality, is also likely to become redundant. His article concludes with an excoriating attack on our politics. He's quite depressed and scathing about the dismal antics in Canberra at the moment. In fact, politicians of all persuasions have been obsessed, he would suggest, and I would too, with one aspect of the ABC's functions to the exclusion of almost everything else. They have been regularly frustrated to the point of personal indignation by the perceptions of political bias and lack of balance which the ABC has brought to its news and current affairs reportage. Some of that is actually true, I think. However, there's a broader point to make. That in turn, of course, has encouraged the ABC to become overly protective of this undoubtedly crucial, though by no means exclusive, aspect of its operations. When one adds into this convoluted mix a modern mania for a certain species of accountability, expressed through the craze for measurements and quotas, accompanied, as such directives always are, by an excruciating jargon of inputs, outputs, performance indicators and the like, it is no wonder that the ABC has, according to the Secretary of the Community and Public Sector Union, Graham Thompson, lost its way. I don't entirely agree. Although I have witnessed firsthand the directives of ABC management to reduce the time and resources available to arts programmes, where once 5 days shooting was the norm, it has become a day or two at the most. Previously 5 days editing was acceptable, it now needs to be achieved in less than 24 hours. Dedicated specialist film and audio crews have been replaced by production pools. The presence of experienced sound and camera operators is in itself, a matter of huge regret to many of my colleagues across Australia. There have been 9 executive producers in ABC TV Arts in as many years, and perhaps the most ironically revealing indication of the corporation's real priorities, the only channel which broadcasts in high definition, News 24, is the one in which the vision is often recorded on small format cameras or even mobile phones. Where it would be a huge aesthetic enhancement of a program such as the recently announced collaborations with Opera Australia, the broadcast is standard definition. Any cursory glimpse at the production schedules for radio or television from the 1950s to the 1980s would reveal a very different emphasis and allocation of resources than is the case today. The range and depth of commissioning, producing and broadcasting in any number of music, operatic, dance and dramatic genres was staggering. And if one were to compare such schedules to the programmes, the public programmes of our galleries, art centres, cinemas, museums and libraries alone, there is something inversely proportional to the ABC's presence. I think a larger problem lurks beneath the surface. And I think it has something to do with the ways in which we choose to describe ourselves. Nick Bryant, in his article, described Australia as a consequential nation. I'm struck not only by the potency of his vocabulary, but perhaps more importantly by how rarely any leader in Australia would ever use such an adjective. Is this then a question of confidence? If, as an artist, I am temperamentally greatly frustrated by the reluctance of conservative politicians to offer any grandiloquent narrative to our public life and its purpose, I am perhaps equally suspicious of the so-called progressive side of politics' tactic of creating an aura of mystique and mythology, quite often on slender grounds and in slight circumstances. It is so frequently proved disappointing, sometimes even hypocritical. My concern is that we are far too comfortable, conformist and uncritical in our assessments of the past and too linear and didactic in our methods of defining our history and our traditions, such as they have been. I also think that the simplistic rhetoric of these narratives is filled with inaccuracy and cant. I do not want to enter into a process of competitive nostalgia, comparing the virtues and vices of one era with another. I simply want us to accept that some of our prevailing truisms are themselves part of the problem. I want us to act as though our cultural life was a matter of great consequence and not some afterthought or peripheral amusement. About 15 years ago, the novelist David Malouf was interviewed by the 7:30 report about the imminent closure of an English department at a university in Northern Australia. He was expected to say how dismayed he was by the decision. Instead, he observed wryly that while, as a writer, he did not celebrate the closure of any place which encouraged serious study of literature, English language or otherwise, he could not help thinking that some scholars and academic institutions had only themselves to blame. He observed that when cultural relativism reaches such a point as to equate an episode of The Bill with King Lear or The Tempest, it would be a natural consequence of such academic priorities that would enable bureaucrats, administrators, and even politicians to act with impunity and without much community concern in the removal of any number of university courses, or indeed universities. It is a situation with strong parallels to the ABC today. So long as the ABC is barely distinguishable from any number of commercial broadcasting outfits, it imperils its own future and purpose. The ABC exists to tell an entirely different kind of narrative to the one in which it seems so fixated, both to and on behalf of all Australians. For many of my professional colleagues, a recent history of the arts in Australia might well be characterised by the prefixes BW or AG, meaning before Whitlam or after Gough, with BW referring to an era of white middle-aged male leaders clad in heavy double-breasted suits with thick eyebrows and scant interest in the arts or other cultural pursuits. Power might have rested with those who used the name liberal, but their attitudes and demeanour were not exactly in keeping with the meaning one might attach to that particular adjective. According to this version of history, AG would refer to another time and place altogether. In the minds of some, at least, a paradise of moderation and understanding, of enlightened political and social reform, the briefest of periods in which huge and transformative changes were wrought, from the establishment of the Australia Council for the Arts and the controversial, though ultimately very canny, acquisition of Jackson Pollock's abstract expressionist masterpiece known as Blue Poles No. 11, to the recognition of Indigenous rights and universal health care, Medicare. Whitlam's 3 years in government were, according to this thesis, a whirlwind of action and change. And for a whole generation of artists and intellectuals, the advent of the Whitlam government was the defining moment in the cultural life of modern Australia. It represented the first tentative steps in a separation from the apron strings of colonialist fixations, of nostalgia for the mother country, a time when white Australia became socially more complex and ethnically more diverse, a period when the defining clichés of an ubiquitous suburbia, of an averaged population obsessed with Axminster and Lamingtons, gave way to a Chardonnay alternative. Or should that be Cardinay? It has been characterised as a period in which we came of age, an all too brief moment in which we became bold in our outlook and ideals, a moment of optimism and altruism that was reflected in our politics and ultimately rejected for equally compelling, though rather more harshly pragmatic reasons. No matter that many of the significant reforms and institutions for which Whitlam is credited actually owe their origins to John Gorton, let the facts not ruin a good story. And according to the same mythology, and in spite of a loathed imperial, not to say mention imperious fiat, which banished Gough and his government to electoral oblivion, much of what he achieved remained intact, and from time to time was ameliorated by figures like Paul Keating, at least so the legend would have it, until the arrival of a certain former member for Bennelong at the Lodge. This narrative may well be compelling. I think it is a considerable simplification of facts and perceptions. It is so often not true. And as we have witnessed through the ideological twists and turns, especially from the ALP in the past few months, it is an unhelpful and unsustainable view both of our history and our cultural progress. Let me offer some provocations to this uncritical orthodoxy. 1972 to 1975. So imagine yourself, for instance, at Eastwood Masonic Hall in June 1947. What would you have heard? A certain Miss Sutherland performing Handel's Acis and Galatea. And later, in August that year, she performed Handel's Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas at the Lyceum Club. A very busy few months for a young woman destined to become one of the greatest divas of the 20th century. And while on the subject of the Sydney Opera House, can I ask that we spare a thought for Joe Carl? The Sydney Opera House was commissioned via an international design competition which attracted 233 entries in 1955 by a premier who, were he alive today, would certainly provide fodder for cartoonists and comedians. Few people remember the brash Redfern railway worker who rose to be Premier of New South Wales for most of the 50s. Even fewer state or federal leaders, past or present, come close to emulating Carl's record for commissioning John Utzon to design Australia's most recognisable architectural icon at Bennelong Point. One only has to look at Darling Harbour to envisage what the governments of the 70s and 80s might have put in its place. If you were a bit of a bookworm, what would you have been reading? Most likely, you'd already be familiar with two of Christina Stead's greatest works, The Man Who Loved Children and For Love Alone, which were published in 1940 and 1945, respectively. And if one imagined a country that cared little for its culture, consider the uproar caused by a literary hoax perpetrated by James Macaulay and Harold Stewart, using a pseudonym of plausible, if quaint, irony, Ernest Laylor Ern Malley. The reverberations and modernist fury of the already angry Penguins, led by Max Harris, were to be felt throughout Australian academia and bohemia, that is to say, in lecture theatres and pubs, for at least half a century. Arriving in the 1960s, the prominent literary critic and anarchist poet Sir Herbert Read declared that a visit to Australia in 1961 was rich in surprises, topographical and cultural. He was genuinely amazed at the range and diversity of the poetry he encountered, from established figures such as David Campbell, Judith Wright, and Kenneth Slessor of Five Bells fame, as well as lesser-known writers, most notably Francis Webb, whose work he compared in stature and importance to Pasternak, Lowell, and Rilke, and whom he considered one of the greatest poets of our time, one of the most unjustly neglected poets of the century. Several generations earlier, Barbara Bainton was to defy the quasi-transcendentalist depictions of the outback of the likes of Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson through a series of ferocious sort stories entitled Bush Studies, which were first published in the Bulletin. The art historian and curator Kenneth Clark's first encounter with the works of Sidney Nolan in 1949 left Clark in no doubt as to the bold, direct originality and intensity of Nolan's work, most especially the iconic Ned Kelly series of paintings, which were created between 1946 and 1947. And while on the subject of that particular notorious Irish bushranger, Charles Tate's 1906 film, The Story of the Kelly Gang, is thought to be the earliest narrative feature, an eloquent testament to the creative daring and innovation of the pioneers of Australian cinema. Produced by the Limelight Studio, which was housed at the Salvation Army headquarters at the top of Bourke Street in Melbourne, a studio which was active between 1897 and 1910, making it one of the earliest film studios in the world. I could continue with many more examples in what might seem a surprising list of diversity and distinctiveness of Australian creativity in successive generations, BW. It is easy to be selective with the mass of information and impressions that constitutes any history. However, I do not want to labour the point about how accurately or faulty our historiography has been. One of the issues raised in many of the recent criticisms of the ABC's decision to disband its TV arts unit concerns the creation and maintenance of an arts archive, the ability to preserve for the future the creative endeavours and artistic aspirations of successive generations of Australian artists and their reactions from Australian audiences. Such a repository of public record provides us all with the ability to explore for ourselves the forces that have shaped our society. To think that such ideas are relevant only insofar as they contain an element of utilitarian populism is a vast simplification of the reciprocal responsibilities between individuals within any society and a diminution of our collective consciousness. The threads of individual artistic achievement to which I have just referred do allow us a place in which it is possible to begin to describe something resembling a collective consciousness. To a great extent, it was such fragments, impressions, individual ideas, works, books, compositions, paintings that formed the basis of the way in which the ABC sought to engage with our culture, and I hope will into the future. These fragments barely scratch the surface, and they do not deal with the myriad of equally compelling aspects of our more recent cultural life. Writers such as Kath Walker, Colin Johnson, or Jack Davis, artists like Albert Namatjira, Rover Thomas, Lynn Onus, Emily Enware or Paddy Bedford, choreographer Stephen Page, musicians William Barton, Christina Arnoux, Deborah Cheatham, Kev Carmody and Archie Roach. I could go on, but time is getting away from us. I came to Australia on this occasion from Poland. I was in Wroclaw to celebrate Poland's term as presidency, as president of the European Union, surely an extraordinary event in anyone's terms. And the Polish presidency was marked by one of the most elaborate and extensive programs of cultural engagement at an official level that I've ever witnessed. In response to a rather facile question from an English journalist, the Polish Minister of Culture, Bogdan Zdrojewski, said with some depth of feeling that if you think that the arts are expensive, try ignorance. Australia can be a very consequential nature, a consequential nation, so long as it has the courage and confidence to take itself sufficiently seriously.
Jonathan Mills, many thanks for an important and beautifully written speech. We'll come to questions and discussion in 10 seconds. Before we do, I'd just like to say thanks to Mallesons for the use of this great facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. You reflected very much, and I swear you look back the period between the 50s and the 80s and you made comparisons with the contemporary period. If you were making similar comparisons with the BBC as against your comments on the ABC, what would you say about the BBC?
First thing to say about the BBC is that it has a guaranteed income stream that is independent, to some extent independent, of government. It was one of the acts, AG, if you like, it was one of the acts of the Whitlam government to remove the licence fee that was paid on televisions in Australia. That system remains in force in the UK. Whether it can survive a period of digital convergence is a big challenge for that organisation. But it does, in fact, deliver, with another trench of money, a substantial amount to the BBC. It is the largest funded cultural organisation in the world, with about a £3 billion budget. It is an organisation without which the ABC itself would be much poorer, it needs to be said. And that's not just for the obvious utilitarian ideas of how many programmes are acquired by the ABC. It's because there's a strong set of connections between the two organisations. There's a shared understanding that what John Reith achieved with the BBC was part of a similar process that encouraged people like Richard Boyer and Charles Moses to think about the ABC in similar ways. There is certainly no doubt that the BBC has retained more of its cultural infrastructure than the ABC has. It still retains its orchestras, and it puts on the largest classical orchestral music programme in the world, the Proms. So there is, everywhere you look, a very robust commitment to the BBC producing all kinds of programmes. My comment and my biggest frustration with the ABC is that there are incredibly talented people, incredibly dedicated people who work for the organisation, who have, particularly in the areas of natural history, science and the arts, been increasingly marginalised over a number of years, and who, if we let their imaginations not even just run riot, but just emerge a little bit better, would do an extraordinary job. And I think they would do a job that would differentiate the ABC in precisely the way that we all wish it would be differentiated.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was brilliant. In 1996, I published a book called Normal Service Won't Be Resumed, and it was on the basis that given its obsession with platforms, so-called, and new technology, the ABC would neglect hiring people. If you go around the various specialist departments, they're either half-deserted or completely deserted. Now, I'll take your speech as a brilliant audition for the job of chairman of the trust, which Maurice Newman vacates in December. When appointed, how will you solve the problem?
By staying in the UK.
You're not allowed.
The answer, that is a cop-out, there's no doubt. But, I mean, I'm not probably available for that role. It's a very nice thing for you to suggest that I would even be considered. However, what I would start to do if I were either a member of the ABC's board or its chair is I would go back to first principles. That's why I spent a bit of time in this paper talking about the charter. And I absolutely think that the charter does not need any alteration. And when you read the 1932 version and you read the 1983 version, I think that politicians of all complexions got it absolutely right. They allowed a huge amount of latitude to the organisation. But I think the conversation that needs to happen is a conversation within the historical framework of what public broadcasting means and how an organisation like the ABC can reflect with its resources, which, OK, we say that they are under challenge, but let's not forget they are $1 billion a year, or just shy of $1 billion a year. I would suggest that if, as a board, we did... and it's not practical in any way, but if we got, like I do every time I start another season at the end of festival, I knew I had $1 billion, and I started with some butcher's paper and a blank whiteboard, I think we could come up with a much more interesting set of ideas than the ones that are being offered at the moment. I don't think we have to reinvent everything. I hope I've been careful in this... this discussion not to be to give credit where it's due, to understand and to try and come to terms with some of the challenges that the ABC itself faces, but actually does come back to a proper conversation about how you frame a national conversation, and you frame a national conversation according to a centre for ideas, a place of an incubator of creativity. I would hope to think that if you did that, that the ABC would actually give birth to a huge amount of other activity, ancillary activity, as you and I know it used to do.
Just following on from that, it seems to me that the chairman of the board and the board don't really have any proper executive power except to appoint or sack the executive director, the CEO of the ABC. So are you suggesting that Mark Scott should be removed? Because it seems to me that all the things that you're describing have all happened under his watch.
I don't agree. I think it's a very long process that has happened. I don't think anyone can blame Mark Scott for the process. But what I would say is that I don't, nor do I agree that the board has no power. I think that, well, for a start, the board appointments are appointments of the Governor General in Council. So there is an extraordinary power provided by the Commonwealth of Australia to the board, and there is a charter. I think what the board needs to do is insist on a completely different interpretation of the charter, and from that kind of thing will flow some of these issues. I don't think it is about micromanaging the organisation. That would be entirely futile. But it is actually asking the organisation to account for why it has gone in a certain direction and to say, hang on a minute, we don't believe that providing X percentage of your budget to news and current affairs is actually an appropriate way for a national broadcaster to operate. What I've hoped to do in this talk is to suggest that there are incredibly diverse things that are of enormous public interest in areas that are not narrowly prescribed by politics. I think also the politicians in this room would agree that they would welcome that kind of broader discourse from the ABC as well.
Can you take it down to the back? Right down the back.
There's another one over there next.
Jonathan, just one thing I wonder if the ABC to a certain extent is a mirror of the culture around it. I just wonder to what extent your position as a composer, assistant director of a festival, you see in Australia, perhaps more broadly, a reluctance, in a sense, for any institution to embrace the kind of project that the ABC initially formed, the Reithian project, which in a sense grows out of the Arnoldian project. A project to say that culture, being the gift of culture, sort of exploration of culture, is in fact the higher purpose of culture, if you like to use those very unfashionable terms. That idea is in itself something that a whole lot of institutions are reluctant to embrace. You referred to Malouf's comments about a quite an episode of The Bill with King Lear. I mean, that kind of relativism, in a sense, is, it seems to me, one of the things that bedevils the ABC's cultural purpose.
I think nature abhors a vacuum. And I think, actually, it is happening. It's just not happening in the ABC. And I think that's a great shame. Because I think that there's a much more interesting... I think there is a very interesting discourse in Australia. I just don't think the ABC is leading it any longer. And I think that is a, genuine shame. That's how I would answer that question in specific terms. Of course, coming to the other part of your question, of course, there are a huge range of challenges to any kind of coherent narrative that an organisation like the ABC can present. But surely that is all the more reason to dedicate resources to the kinds of programmes that you, Tony, were so very much part of inventing and sustaining for so many years. I think there's another issue here. I think that in our mania for measuring things, we have absolutely missed the broader sense of what that measurement means. We measure an audience, but do we actually measure our creative capacity? Do we look at the same time as we're measuring an audience with the amount of money that the Commonwealth Government, for example, just in one example, is spending on the Australian Youth Orchestra, the Australian National Academy of Music, any number of music departments in tertiary institutions, let alone at preschool, secondary school level. Such discussions and negotiations are, I think, a much better example of how to think of how to measure the sector and its significance. And if you do that, then I think you'll have a completely different set of objectives and set of emphases.
Yes, this year, past year, I've seen some marvellous plays on the stage in Australia, marvellous actors. I don't think I've ever seen any of those actors on the ABC, and I don't think I ever see any plays. Some of the Australian plays, some of the great classics, but I just never see them on the ABC. I don't know why. Yes.
I don't really want to get into, for the purposes of this discussion, what's on or what's not on the ABC. Because I want to... I'm sure you're right. I'm sure equally that we need to give the ABC a level of independence to actually make their own decisions about who is on the ABC or not. What I'm concerned about is that there is a much more serious general trend that doesn't seem to be allowing the organisation to have any arts policy or any broadly curated direction within the arts whatsoever. So you can have my film of my opera broadcast, thank good, I'm delighted, but it's an arbitrary decision. When that was brought to the ABC, it was done because people liked Julian Temple, they liked Dorothy Porter, they had heard of me, and of course because Arthur Stace was a famous Sydney figure. But actually, the project that made that at Channel 4 was a very dedicated stream of programming that thought that opera should be made idiomatic for television. And over a period of 20 years, Jan Young Husband commissioned some of the finest film directors to work closely with composers and librettists and to transform their work into the idiom of television. Michael Colgan from the Gate Theatre of Dublin has created a worldwide audience over a period of 25, 30 years for a writer as esoteric as Samuel Beckett, culminating in getting people like Julianne Moore and Jeremy Irons, amongst many other Hollywood luminaries, to create the complete works of Beckett on film, and then taking the complete works of Beckett on a 43-town tour of Ireland. He played on Broadway. I think we need to make a very fundamental distinction in this between what ratings mean and what mass marketing means, and an investment in not just the imagination of our artists, but the imagination of our audiences. They're completely different things.
We're getting close to the end. Yes, question.
Thanks. Jonathan, you mentioned we had two themes, amongst others, of a need for confidence and for the mission of the ABC to be complementary to other channels. I wonder if you have a view as to whether part of the problem is not just a lack of confidence in promoting more complementary activities, but a reluctance to let go of the news and current affairs, because the ABC doesn't quite trust, or some people in the ABC don't quite trust, the Australian public to form views about political questions and other current affairs matters if they don't receive them from the ABC.
Can I just make... That's our final question, so you can come up with a final answer.
Yeah. Wow. Yes, I think the best answer that I can give to that is that there has been a certain retreat within the ABC to defend a certain territory that it perceived to be under attack. I don't think that was ever exactly true. I think, like all things, these discussions and debates get terribly personalised and terribly emotional. There are sufficient checks and balances and sufficient guarantees of independence for the ABC to be guaranteed of its independence, notwithstanding the threat by successive governments to defund it. That's never happened. It has certainly had, from time to time, considerable real-term reductions in its funding. But I actually think it's precisely because the ABC itself had a siege mentality, and precisely because politicians have perceived that is the overwhelming activity of the ABC, that all sorts of other things have been lost. Bananas in Pyjamas, The Science Show, to name two completely disparate examples. And I do that quite deliberately. But I do actually think that if there had been a greater public conversation about those other elements, and a greater level of leadership and acclaim given, and a greater emphasis given by the ABC to precisely those kinds of things, I do think that some of this may not have occurred. I also think that there is a challenge of any large institution, and it's the same whether it is an opera house in Germany, a broadcasting organisation in Australia, a national ballet company in the UK, that they start to believe that there is a certain role for them to authenticate what we do and what we think. And I think that needs to be challenged. And I don't think it is to be challenged by political aggression. I think it actually needs to be challenged by force, weight, knowledge and passion about alternative stories and alternative histories.
Many thanks, John. Just step aside. Congratulations to Jonathan Mills on his AO. Thanks to Senator George Brandeis, who's here tonight, who told us that Mr. Mills will be in Sydney around this time. Without question, the ABC is one of the most important institutions in Australia. It's important to have considered discussions on the ABC. Maurice Newman, the ABC chairman, will be speaking for the Sydney Institute later in the year. But for now, I'd just like to say many thanks to Jonathan Mills for a very significant speech with a lot of historical depth, a challenging speech, and I'm sure that one that will live on well beyond tonight, which is what we're all about. Jonathan Mills said to me he'd love to come back when he's next in Australia, and we'd love to have him back, particularly after tonight's fine performance. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.